story, but mushrooms and mulch. And what actually is a fungus is the first question. Some people think of fungus as being a plant. Some people think of fungus being an animal, maybe. I think probably most people think of it being a plant. Well, first question is, what's the plant? What's the difference between a plant and an animal, and how are we going to put the mold or fungus into this category? Well, most of you would probably say, well, no trouble telling a plant from an animal. Plants are green and animals walk around. Is that satisfactory? However, fungus isn't green. It doesn't walk around either, though. So here's again the problem. Usually we think of plants as having chlorophyll and producing their own fruit, but fungus does not. It's dependent upon some other source of food. Yet it isn't. We think of animals usually being motile, and yet some plants are. There are green algae that are motile, so this isn't a crucial category either. Well, characteristics of your molds, they're rather different from most other organisms, and really, they're probably a transition type of thing. Many of our primitive organisms are, you can't fit into a plant versus animal category. This is a man-made division, and it works fine for higher plants and higher animals, but this doesn't work for things like bacteria, fungus, and primitive algae. So, the fungus has a structure that's a very thin tubular structure. This is the main body of your fungus. We call it a mycelium. It's very cottony and spirit-like. And so you've seen it one time or another, you know, this white mold on things. Even if you go out hiking, you can see this white cottony mold, sometimes on wood. Incidentally, fungus is pretty important, and I'm going to try to bring out some of the relationships between fungus and man. If it weren't for fungus, when trees fall down in the woods, they'd be there, you know, and we'd have piles and piles of trees stacked up. There would be no disintegration of your trees. The leaves decay and ultimately go into humus and form our soil. If it weren't for mold, you wouldn't have this. True bacteria count for a small amount, but a good deal of it is the mold. And they're important in this respect. And then, of course, molds are also have been rather significant in coral. In some cases, it can be a whole complete living organism. And how does it function about the intricacies of it? And then some of the implications of this. First off, a cell, when you draw a picture of a cell, maybe some of you have taken biology, and you know, in the book, you'll always see a nice little cubicle structure like this, and then a pretty little nucleus like center. Well, not all cells look like this. They're variable shapes, and even some of the cells inside your body have a very different shape. So this is maybe one kind of a cell, but certainly not a typical cell by any means. And so the shape is extremely variable. Take, for example, an organism called amoeba. You look at it once, and then you look at it again, it's different. In other words, the shape of the cell itself actually changes continually. And then there are some single-celled organisms that have very attractive cell shapes, so extremely variable. The size of cells is also quite variable. They range from, you know, submicroscopic, which you can't even see under the microscope, up to a huge thing, some 4 feet long even. So size varies considerably. Using cells that are extremely long, however, it isn't the whole cell that's long. Take, for example, a nerve cell may look something like this, but it's just the extensions that are long. But really, the major part of the cell is no larger than any other cell. And there are some plant cells called fiber cells that are extremely long, too, but they're very thin. Have you ever had skin beans, for example, that were really chewy, fibrous? That would be a plant fiber cell, and some of these are quite long. Okay, as far as kinds of cells, let me mention first a few different kinds. Some cells can be complete organisms in themselves. Just for example, algae. These are so-called primitive plants, and they, in many cases, are just a single cell. One of them, some of them are maybe pear-shaped like this, and maybe have a couple of little flagella, and they swim around.
But how do you know they're plants? Because they have this chlorophyll. So these are single cells, and they're on. They're variable too. Also, we have primitive animals that are single cells. Maybe some of you have heard of good old paramecium. That's a single cell organism. Yeah, we still use around. There's a bunch of little cilia. And then, of course, the bacteria, which is extremely small. And if you look at them under the microscope, they look like this little dot dancing in front of your eye. So these are types of cells that are complete in themselves. Yet in other cases, like in higher plants and animals, the cells are only a portion of a larger thing. Let's take some different kinds of plant cells, for example. We have some plant cells that are just like little pipes. And they look something like this. And there may be some holes in them. Incidentally, when they carry on their two functions, they're dead. And their function is to act as a pipeline, and they transmit water. Nothing more than this. They're fairly strong, and they give support to the plant and conduct the water up from the roots to the top of the plant. And take, for example, a tree. All the things that you call wood, let's look at a stump, tree stump, no? And here's the bark, and here's the wood. The main portion of a tree. And that is all, just about all those kinds of cells. The function of the wood is to conduct these water up from the roots. It has considerable strength because the walls of these cells are really thick. And also there's some other thinner cells, the basic cells that we call fibers. And the fibers are nothing but very long, thin cells with much of cell wall. And these give the strength to the wood. And so your wood then is using nothing more than a bunch of these little pipes all together. If you can get a thin enough section of wood and hold it up to the light, you'll see all these little skin tricks. And these are the cross sections of these little pipes that carry the water up. So that's one kind of cell. Another kind of cell in plants conducts food, and it will send out the food down to the roots. These cells are right here. The division line between the wood and the bark. Actually, it's included in the bark. Have you ever heard that stripping the bark from a tree is harmful? You may have heard of that. You know that if you were to take the bark and make a complete strip around the tree, very effective at killing the tree. You don't have to chop it down or anything. Just a complete ring around, because it means that the food goes to that point, but it can't bridge the gap. You see, because in the bark, it is by these cells to conduct the food down. So, in that, the food gets down from the roots down to that point, and then the roots, of course, die. And so, in the course of the year, they effectively kill the tree. A lot of times, foresters, when they go to thin out a particular area, maybe they don't have time to cut the trees down, but they will strip the bark around, and that automatically will kill the tree in the course of the year. So, those then are cells. They look rather similar to these, except they're living cells, and they conduct the food down. Then in the outer area of the bark, we have cork cells. This is where we get our cork, incidentally. And what's the function of cork? What do you use cork for? Stop a bottle or something, and so it keeps the water in, so to speak. Well, cork has a waterproofing function, so it protects the tree, so to speak. And probably what you associate, what you call bark, is really cork. But what the botanist calls bark includes this inner layer. If you strip the bark from a tree, you'll notice it's sort of green and smooth right on the inside. And that's the conducting, that layer of cells that conducts the food down. So those are different kinds of cells. Cork cells, if you look at them under the microscope, just look like little cubes. Incidentally, 1665 was when the first cell was observed, was Robert Hooke. And he was looking at cork. He had a very primitive microscope, was looking at a thin section of cork, and he saw these little cubes and thought, well, gee, they look like cells. And that was the name that he gave to them. And so we, you see, now call them cells from the first section that he looked at, which was cork. So these court cells are very thick walled, and mm-hmm. they have a waterproofing substance in them that makes them waterproof for the client. Then, as I mentioned, these fiber cells are mainly for strengthening, and you can find them considerably in the trunk of a tree, certainly, that gives it, you know, the support to hold up the whole tree. You can also find it in any plant that lives for any length of time. So if you eat asparagus, it's a little on the old side, you begin to get a bunch of fibers, and that's why asparagus gets real, you know, all these long strings that you have in asparagus. Celery is another one. Have you ever seen the strings in celery? Those are a type of fiber cell. And the strings in string beans, or any older kind of vegetable, it begins to get that kind of thing. Have you ever eaten pears? And you've noticed that this is a gritty substance in pear. That, again, is a fibrous type of cell, except that the cell, instead of being long and thin, is pretty much cubical, and so you don't get a stringiness, but just a gritty, sandy type of thing. This, again, cell walls that you're chewing on that are a little thicker, and so gives it some appearance. Then there are also in plants are cells that do nothing but carry on photosynthesis. These would be the cells you find in leaves, and their function would be to produce the food, and they would have lots of little bodies that we call chloroplasts. Then there are other cells that store food, and in the potato, if you took a look at the cells of potato, you find millions and millions of dark frames in them. And they are something like this with little concentric rings, but thousands of these if you look at the potato, and they're dark. So whenever you look at the cells that store food, and then you find these dark things. So these are kind of some examples of the kinds of cells that we have in plants. Animals, we also have a lot of interesting kinds of cells. We have red blood cells. Example there, they look like little donuts, except they don't have a hole in them completely. It's just a little indentation in cross section. They look like that, or looking at it from the top, they look sort of like donuts. And these red blood cells are extremely important because they carry the oxygen and enable you to breathe. So, a person who's anemic doesn't have enough red blood cells. Therefore, they don't get enough oxygen, and therefore they're out of breath if you, you know, just walk across the room or something. That would be lack of these kinds of cells. We have white blood cells that can be irregular in shape, and their function is to engulf bacteria and destroy them. Then we have cells in bone. Bone is living, and there are cells in bone. We have muscle cells. We have heart cells. Incidentally, heart cells are rather interesting because if we separate heart tissue we call it in vitro, outside the living body, separate the cells, we find that some of these heart cells just beat spontaneously, just as though, you know, we're a complete heart. The cell itself will beat and have this same characteristic, which is rather interesting. Then we have nerve cells, which I showed you before. This is the main center of the nerve cell. Then these long stringers, where the nerve impulse travels along and from one to another. The nerve cells connect, and here would be one end here, and then another one would connect here, and there's your other. So in other words, like I prick myself right here, what happens? The nerve here, the impulse travels up here, goes up to the brain, and tells me, okay, you're being pricked there. And then it may come back, and then my brain may say, okay, pull your leg away from that annoying thing. And so then the impulse comes back here and triggers the muscle, so I pull my leg away. This happens very rapidly. And here again, you know, with a reflex type of thing, I hit myself here, and instantaneously my leg goes up, but the impulse has to go first through the spinal cord and then has to come back out again to hit the appropriate muscle to, you see, make me move my leg. So this would be the impulse then travels along this fiber, which is extremely important. So that's another kind of cell. We also have cells that store fat, and some people have more than others, as you know. And And we also have cells that are, we call them epithelial, they're surface cells. And these are continually being replaced. You know, you can scratch at the surface of your skin and sometimes you get flakes off, or maybe in the scalp, or even in the lining of your cheek. You just scrape with a toothpick or something and then put the smear on a microscope. So I just found out cells that you aren't even aware you're scraping off of your cheek. These are continually replaced. Another. So these are all different kinds of cells that each carry on a particular function. Okay, what about these cells? What I want to do now is to describe a little bit about these generalized cells. If you study a cell, it's simply fantastic, all the things that are in it and what they do. Because the cell is a complete organism in itself. It does everything. It's rather fantastic. Here's the central portion of the cell, which we call the nucleus. The nucleus is the control of the cell. In other words, it's the regulator, has all the information telling the cell what to do and how to behave. And then outside the cell is a sort of a sticky substance that does all the work. In other words, here's the mastermind, and this is where all the work is performed in the cell. And this area we call cytoplasm. And in the cytoplasm, if you can look at it under an electron microscope, you can see all little things in it. In other words, it's just not homogeneous. It's very heterogeneous with many different things in it. What are some of these different things? One of them is a rod-like body looking something like that. Why don't I enlarge it? And it has an infolded membrane around it. Inside. And this thing, I'll give you the name. Some of you may have had biology or otherwise, but it's called mitochondria. You might think of it as mighty, so mito. It is the powerhouse of the cell. And without this, life certainly would not be possible. This is where all the energy is produced then otherwise. For energy, to have energy, what we need to do is so-called respire, breathe. This enables energy because we break down the food we eat. You know, if you eat a piece of bread, you know, it's 52 calories or something. What does this mean? It means that when you eat it, the food is broken down, it finally respires, and you get heat from it, heat energy. In other words, it's what the calories are, and that piece of bread's worth 52 or whatever it is, units of energy or heat. So where is it done? Ultimately, in the cell, in the mitochondria, they carry on the respiration breakdown and produce carbon dioxide and water. Those would be the end products of that bread you eat, carbon dioxide and water. And plus lots and lots of energy, which would be the so-called calories. But the energy, the mitochondria put the energy up into a storage form that we call ATP. And ATP is adenosine triphosphate, so it's called ATP. And this is the only instant energy of the cell. And you hear about a candy bar being instant energy. What is it really? The only instant energy is ATP. And okay, you need a candy bar. When is it instant energy? Only after it's been digested, taken into the cell, respired by the mitochondria, put in the form of ATP, then it's instant energy. Until then, it isn't. So how long does that take? Well, it depends on what else you've eaten, but the candy bar, the sugar in it does not go into the blood. The sugar is sucrose, and it has to be digested into a monosaccharide first, into glucose. So it goes through the stomach, and the enzyme that digests sucrose is in the small intestine, so it has to get into the small intestine. This may be anywhere from 15 minutes to maybe an hour later. And then it gets into the blood, and then it would go, then the blood carries it to the cells, and then the cells respire it, the mitochondria, produce ATP, then you've got your instant energy. So, it takes a while. Okay, ATP is instant energy. Empty cells are producing this. Supposing you run now, you're a runner. Supposing you also hold your breath, you know. So Sometimes, you know, you run for a period of time and hold your breath. What happens? All of a sudden, you have to start breathing. You start panting, don't you? Why? You've got a lack of oxygen and oxygen starvation. Why? What's happened? You've used up the ACT, you've not got any more, and you're going to collapse unless you get some more. How do you get some more? You must supply oxygen to the cell so the mitochondria can, respire, so to speak, and produce some more ACT. But you have to have oxygen. And so this is why you pant. It's a means of replenishing this so-called oxygen debt. And so we have to supply the cells with oxygen so that they can, produce more ATP. Because, in other words, without ATP, the muscles don't contract and, no worse.
In other words, taking a big breath would be more good than that candy bar?
Well, ultimately, you do need the candy bar because, right. But it isn't instant energy, you see. The only instant energy would be supplying the cells with oxygen and supposing that you do have a level of sugar in the blood. But in other words, you will need it. So there's no harm, you see, in this respect. But it's a misnomer called instant energy, which really the only instant energy is the ATP. So.
When you were
hiking
up,
the light.
So
really, if
you'll get
dizzy. Yeah, now this is over oxygenation. In other words, it's known that if you take in too much oxygen, in a period of time, it can cause a dizziness in the brain. Apparently, it's a triggering response with too much oxygen and hyperventilating. In other words, if you were to sit here and go, for about 20 times, then over-oxygenation can begin to cause dizziness. Right. So, in other words, relax, be natural. Your body more or less tells you what to do. I mean, that's abnormal, and you would not normally do this. But in a race, you normally can't, and so don't fight it. In other words, it's normal. So, yes, to an extent. In other words, you have to be careful, though, so that you don't go beyond the point, and then you have this extra store of oxygen. Yes, or a lot of times divers will do this, too. We do it experiment. Sometimes it's physiology. We have the people hyperventilate for a certain period of time, and then just relax, and it's a considerable length of time before you feel the need to take another breath. And so, you see, it would give you that extra bit of time, you see, if you were to do some diving. Okay, what are some of the other things you might find in your cytoplasm? Another real exciting little interesting one that was discovered not too long ago, called a lysosome, LYSOSOME. It's a little body in the cytoplasm. But it's a really potent one. It's surrounded by a membrane, and inside this are very, very strong digestive juices, such that if I were to poke that, break open the membrane, the digestive juices would come out and it would just eat up the whole cell. And, it just dissolves itself. So these are extremely potent enzymes inside it. Well, what is the function of the lysosome? It is the digestive system of the cell, so to speak. But, you see, because the enzymes are so potent, we can't rupture this membrane or otherwise the whole cell, you see, eats itself up. And in some cases, diseases are the result of faulty rupturing of this membrane. You see, if we learn of ways we can stop the rupturing of this membrane, you see, we can stop the death of the cell.
Is this more prevalent than in a cancer cell? Because
you took the number actually. This we don't know. They have been studying the relationship between cancer and lysosomes, and it does seem as though there is a premature breakage of the lysosome in the cancer condition. So in other words, they're using this as another line of attack as far as cancer is concerned. Maybe we can find a way of controlling perhaps faulty action of the lysosome. But it's a rather interesting thing. How does it act? Supposing, let's think about the white blood cell. The white blood cell eats up bacteria. Here's a white cell, and here's a bacterium here. The white cell engulfs the bacterium. So there, the bacteria is inside the white cell. What happens next? Is the lysosome unites with this sort of vacuole of the bacteria, and the two fuse, and the lysosome dissolves the bacteria. And then the waste is sort of discharged in the opposite way that the whole thing came in. So it engulfs the bacteria, the lysosome of the bacteria fuse, and it digests the bacteria, and then dumps it out. So it's a complete digestive system in itself. But sometimes now, supposing a person's working in a factory in which there's a lot of silica, and you may have heard of the silicosis, which is a disease. What happens here now, the white cells go to town, and they engulf these silica particles. You know, they don't know they're not bacteria or anything. And it fuses with the lysosome again. Except there's a little problem. The enzymes don't do anything to glass. We can't digest glass. So what happens is that we've got now these silica particles engulfed inside the lysosome. Well, apparently, they trigger a reaction that breaks the lysosome, causing then the release of the enzyme, destruction of the cell, and then the particles are released, you see, and then another cell picks them up. And so it's sort of a chain reaction, and can actually then cause a condition known as silicosis. What actually happens with the enzymes, apparently, there's the body lays down a fibrous material that deposits in the lungs, and it results in poor breathing. So, and this is a case in which a problem results because of the lysosome. Sometimes it's desirable for the membrane of the lysosome to break. What about a tadpole? You know, a tadpole has a tail, and the frog doesn't. Well, how to get rid of the tail? You see, the cells just sort of eat themselves up. The membrane of the lysosome ruptures, the cell dissolves, and that's the end of it, until you get rid of your tail. Or, another thing, too, sometimes cells, you know, are faulty, or it's a way of getting rid of undesirable cells, you see. It's self-destruction of cells through this lysosome. It appears that many inflammations and allergic conditions seem to be, again, a breakage of the lysosome. These enzymes cause inflammation and the symptoms that we get in many allergic reactions. It's also known that cortisone tends to stabilize the membrane of the lysosome. So if you give cortisone to certain inflammations and allergic conditions, then it cuts down the reaction by stabilizing the lysosome membrane. A lot of work is being done with the lysosome and serious diseases. It seems to be related, but we don't know yet actually the relation in cancer and the lysosome, but here again seems to be a very promising source of research. Another very important structure in plant cells is a structure that's a little larger than these others I've been speaking about. You can readily see it in the microscope. It's the chloroplast. This is a nice little, usually electrical shape, let's say, structure containing the green chlorophyll. And this is where the photosynthesis takes place. Incidentally, photosynthesis is extremely important for life. Without photosynthesis, there would be no life whatsoever. So this is the single process that produces food from an undying source of energy. The energy to produce the food is the sun. You see, as long as we have a sun, we can have this continuing life. Because all we need is carbon dioxide, water, and the sun. And what could be simpler than that, you see? Both of these are, easily supplied. Carbon dioxide, of course, in great abundance from just respiration, you see. And then water is abundant, and the sun, that's all we need. There's no other way of producing food using these simple things other than the so-called photosynthetic process. There are some bacteria that produce food by means of chemical energy. But this couldn't be permanent because what happens when you use up your chemicals? So if we were all so-called chemosynthetic, that would be fine for a short period of time, but after we've all used up the chemicals, that's it. But this photosynthesis, the use of energy from the sun, sun's light, and so you can continually produce food energy. So actually, it's been surmised that if we're going to look for life on other planets, what you look for first is photosynthesis. That's the only way you can have a permanent type of life. Otherwise, it will be relatively impermanent. So this occurs in the chloroplast. In the chloroplast, we have a variety of pigments. We have not only chlorophyll, but we have other pigments. One of these is a yellow pigment we call the yellow pigment, which is carotenoid. And carrots, for example, have a lot of these pigments. And you know, in the New England area, lots of ground here to a certain extent in the fall, the leaves turn color, the volcano. What happens? In many cases, the chloroplast disintegrates, or the chlorophyll disintegrates, you see. And there's no more green. What happens then? You see the yellows and the reds, which are left. They're already in the chloroplast, but you don't see them because it's made up by so much chlorophyll. So when they disappear, then you see these yellows and oranges. And this happens then, triggered in usually by either frost or day length or cold. Cold and triggered it, disintegration of the chlorophyll, and then you have the other colors, the beautiful fall colors. Some species, the maple tree, for example, sugar maple, also produces an accessory pigment, which is the bright yellow. But in many cases, it's just the pigments that we're causing in the chloroplast, but once the chlorophyll's gone, you see these other colors. So this is the least function of your chloroplast. And they call it, a common name for it would be plastic. And we use another, we call it chloroplast if it has the green pigment. We call it a chromoplast if it has pigments other than the green. For example, you know, when fruit dries, it may also turn red or some other color. Take a tomato, it starts out green and then it turns red when it's ripe. Again, disintegration of these chlorophyll and then the red pigments go through. So just another example of some of the things that you can find inside this. Yourself. And surrounding the cell is a membrane, which is extremely important because if you didn't have it, obviously you wouldn't have a cell. You know, everything would spill out into the surrounding medium. So the membrane keeps the contents of the cell intact. And it also acts as a selective mechanism. It allows certain things to come into the cell, and it only allows certain things to get out. In other words, water goes in and out readily, but it keeps the protein and all these particles inside the cell, and also allows, you know, food particles, certain things to come in and out. So it's extremely important. And so this is generally the function of the membrane to selectively allow things to pass in and out and then to contain the cell. Plant cells produce another cell wall. Animal cells don't. The plant cells have a rigid structure on the outside. The function of this is to prevent the cell from bursting. We find that if you place a cell in pure water, the water tends to go into the cell more than to come out. And then the cell swells and swells. And if you didn't have a way of getting rid of the excess water or a way of containing it, it could burst. So the cell wall then retains the shape of the cell. Well, animals, many animal cells that are living in pure water to prevent this have a type of vacuole that acts like a veil, and it's called a contractile vacuole, and it contracts periodically and pumps out the excess water that comes in. So it doesn't need a cell wall. It pumps out the water with a vacuole. But the plants don't have that. They have a cell wall, and so the cell expands to that point, and that's it. If you destroy that cell wall, the cell will explode. Okay. Also, in cytoplasm, you can find little droplets of oil or food particles or this type of thing. And also, there's a membrane system all throughout here that probably acts to carry food particles and, you know, get things in and out and around the cell. And on this membrane are little particles, little round particles, that are concerned with production of protein, producing all the growth material of the cell, and the protein production and the synthesis of all the things that occurs then in the cytoplasm. Okay, the controlling part of the cell now is this nucleus. This nucleus tells the cell has all the information necessary for producing all the substances necessary, and actually, if the organism is multicellular, like man, it has all the information necessary for producing a whole new person, all function and everything. And this is contained inside this nucleus. So if you look in the nucleus, what do you see there? You see, essentially, chromosomes, which are rod-like structures. And one other structure you see as nucleus, which is a little structure like that. There may be more than one, often two or more. So we have chromosomes and we have a nucleus. The chromosomes are just rod-like structures that contain a very, very important substance, DNA. DNA is the hereditary material of the cell. It has all the information on it for reproduction and for producing a whole new cell or new organism. The chromosomes then have DNA. The nucleus is a structure that has another very important substance, RNA. RNA is very similar to DNA. In fact, DNA stamps out RNA, but it's slightly different. It's only a single strand instead of double. And RNA then goes out into the cytoplasm and does the work. In other words, DNA is the man that sits in the office, you know, and okay, you do this and that. And RNA is the little runner that goes out into the cytoplasm, carrying all the news from DNA, but then does the work. So all the work is done by RNA, this synthesis of protein, but it stands out from DNA. So it has a very exact message you see from DNA. And DNA is in the nucleus. And it would be specifically in the chromosomes. Well, how do we know that the nucleus controls the cell? What we can do is to take the nucleus out of the cell and put it in, what they often do is work in primitive organisms. One of them is a little plant that you can find in the sea, and it has just a single nucleus. What they do is take the nucleus out of one plant, stick it into another one, take the nucleus out of that other one, and, you know, transplant and see if this nucleus you can even use some different species of strains and find out how this nucleus affects this other thing. And we find that it does. It controls how the path of this particular plant develops. It's all controlled by this nucleus. So if we can't plant, you know, this one would get the type of path that could have been in this other plant. So the nucleus is extremely important, and it does control the vegetative characteristics. Another experiment that was performed that demonstrates again this, that the nucleus has all of the information necessary for producing a whole complete organism, is first performed with respect to carrot. What we do is to take a cell from a carrot. You know, we had carrot for lunch yesterday. So you just take one of those cells from the carrot and place it into the medium, put it in coconut milk. This is a medium that very all encompassing type of medium that is very similar to the medium that surrounds the embryo. In other words, if the fertilized egg grows, it's surrounded by something similar to coconut milk. So if you put that carrot in coconut milk and you know, keep it at nice warm temperature and keep moving it around in the coconut milk, it would be possible for that single cell of the carrot that you ate yesterday to grow. And then you could get them such as you have tiny rootlets, little tops, and you could put them in soil and they're there. So not one single cell. So what enabled it was the nucleus. It was the information in the nucleus that enabled complete production of a new carrot.
Well,
pardon me? The seed ultimately, when the seed starts, it starts out with one cell, which is the fertilized egg. But then the actual seed that's in the tree is more than that. It has grown a bit. It's surrounded by a coat. There's nutrient material, and the embryo is in here, which is, in other words, this sort of, I think, has grown, has divided maybe 1,000 or 200 or 300 or 400,000 times into just starting, you know, a little tiny miniature plant starting. And it's surrounded by trees and then by a seed coat to protect it. So the seed is a fantastic means of survival because it has a very thick seed coat. It's very difficult to crack in some cases. Surrounded by trees, a lot of nice trees, the barrier is just starting enough to, you know, ensure that it can keep going. And there it is. And it can survive a fantastic number of years in its complete condition. Some trees have known to have survived more than 1,000 years. So, I think that is a fantastic. This seed is a protective mechanism. This is why the most abundant plants. You look around, there are a lot of plants. Some of you are not even aware of being plants. But the most abundant plants you find there outside is a seed plant. Your pine trees have seeds, grass has seeds, flowers have seeds, all of those plants appear to have seeds. The only plants that don't have seeds would be ferns, and they certainly are the major part of the vegetation. Ferns don't moth, they're small yet. Those are cedar plants. But the sea plants, because of it, have, you know, really adapted themselves into the presence of the very young people. This is now the same experiment was carried out with respect to animals. This is rather recently, but this is done. They did the same experiment with animals, which they took the nucleus. In this case, they took the nucleus from a frog, frog cell, it was taken from the lining of the intestine. So, you know, just a little epithelial cell, and this is all taken a perhaps a cell from the skin somewhere, but they took the cell from the lining of the intestine, the single cell, took the nucleus out of that cell, placed it into an egg, and that's the nucleus had been removed. You know, so here's the egg. They took this egg and put it out. They put the nucleus of the intestine cell out of that egg. Okay, what happened? Well, you see, in some cases, maybe you have 100% success, but in many cases, I think it was 5 or 10%, they did complete frog. From just the nucleus that they took out of the intestine. And the frog was, of course, identical to the frog of the one they took from the intestine, and not the frog from where they got the egg. So you see, this nucleus then, that's all they did was put the nucleus in there, and it had all the information necessary to grow a whole new cell. Because all they had to do was to get this nucleus in the right environment. If you have the nucleus in another environment, it will behave differently. So the two things are the nucleus plus what this environment tells it what to do. But the information is here, and the environment tells it what to do. Right, they could have taken the nucleus from any part of that frog. Yes, it would be identical. Well, I would call frogs, not really females. No, it has not been done, but I would say the chances are, if you could get the right conditions, that the principle we get from this would be valid. In other words, if we could do it, get the right conditions, it would be theoretically possible to do. We have not as yet been able to make the human egg divide outside of the reproductive tract. But you see, it would be possible to plant the egg with this so-called nucleus into a reproductive tract.
Well, I
think
that the
nucleus
is something that the human being
can
make the egg.
Yes, generally we find this to be true. The more complex the organism, the more easy it is to destroy the cell. We find that just for example, resistance to radiation. Single-celled organisms can tolerate somewhere between 50,000 to 100,000 rankings of radiation. Human cell is disturbed with a little over 25 rankings is all that's necessary to cause breakage of chromosomes. You see, we have so many more chromosomes, it's so much easier to cause failure just by some environmental factors. When you have 46 chromosomes instead of zero. Certainly a factor, it's probably a cytoplasmic factor, you see, that triggers then regrowth, you see, which we don't have. In other words, we get action if the cytoplasm around the nucleus tells it to, okay, build this or that. And it must be a cytoplasmic factor then surrounding this particular area that then triggers the regrowth. I don't know if they are or not, but one used to certainly, you know, be kind of a post, I'm not certain if they are. And all kinds of about, you know, storing these, you see, you know, for potential future use. Okay, I'll close off here, and if anyone wants to ask more questions, feel free to ask me. But summary, the cell is really, that is fantastic, how it, you know, contains all the different cells. It functions only as a unit or a group if there's another cell adjacent that will influence it. But a cell, if you separate it from its environment, can and will act independently. But when, it's sort of like people in a way, you know, if you separate them, they can function pretty well independently, but when you have them in a group, they behave differently than how they might, you know, go to see this as well. In other words, could it be a mistake within? I think generally, you know, mutation would be is determined if there's a mistake in a chromosome. And I think, although we don't know what causes chromosome mutation, it's probably something fundamental. We don't know. But, I mean, if anything environmental, it's not inside the chromosome itself. Then anything outside of the DNA is probably what causes the DNA to become faulty.
I have a
It's what you consider life. No one knows. This is the problem, you see. No two people would define life as the same thing. So, yes, they have been able to produce DNA, which some people define as life. So if you're going to define DNA as life, then yes, they have produced life. But they have not produced a cell like this, which other people define life as a cell. Oh, definitely. Unless some other changes take place, if you change the program by Devin Sue last night after Vespers, if you came there, there are a lot more problems that we've got to take care of before that would ever occur. And I don't think we'll be here that long unless we take care of the problems at hand. Yeah, right.
Well, I was a little bit of a down for your life, your ability to adapt to different environments, the environment changes the fact that when the story of life is happening to you, it's quite cool. The environment is changing the country.
If it changes too fast, then you've got that pattern. But because normally the environment did not change that fast, and we are that the survival of fit. They survive
now.
It's at a lower temperature, you see. The other may have been rather critical as far as you could easily have a different strain, you see, by breeding. Yeah, right. And it was pretty critical, so it might be a new strain, you see. This can grow at lower temperatures and less critical. That's probably aspect of it, too. In other words, they can breed for better yeast, you see, just like we breed for plants that have more yield and stuff. But it would be the same thing, essentially, but maybe a different variety, different strain. Okay, I think we covered most of it. There are a lot of other interesting club fungus. Maybe you've seen some of them. Some of them have the shape of a star with a little puffball center, and we call them earth stars. Another sort of interesting one looks like a bird's nest. They're very small, and it has the reproductive structures right in the center that look like bird's eggs. It's called bird's nest fungus. So, a lot of interesting little ones that you can find. But, particularly in the latter group, the club fungus, because they have visible fruiting bodies. Okay, that's all, too. I'm sorry, what? Yeah, I'm going to mention a little bit about this on Friday when we talk.